Thank you, everyone, for coming so late in the day to hear us talk about everybody's favorite tobacco control topic, e-cigarettes. I'm going to be talking about preventing nicotine poisoning among children and youth. Thank you, Cynthia. As Robert said, thank you for the generous introduction that I wrote myself. as Robert said, I'm a staff attorney with the Public Health Law Center. We're part of the Tobacco Control Legal Consortium. We're attorneys who are supporting tobacco control policy change throughout the country. So if you're thinking about tobacco control policy and you have legal questions, we're there to help you for free. And it's finally 2015, so I don't have to include the slide that says this is an e-cigarette and this is what it does. You're all here, so you know. This is a graph from the CDC's data that was released in April from the National Youth Tobacco Survey, which I'm sure you're all familiar with. In the past 30 days, high schoolers had experimented with e-cigarettes. The rate of use in the past 30 days between 2013 and 2014 more than tripled, and as you can see, e-cigarettes are one of the only products that is increasing in use. So we're at a point now where e-cigarettes are everywhere. We also know that nicotine is toxic. At lower levels of exposure, nicotine exposure, the symptoms look a lot like what naive tobacco users experience when they first experiment with tobacco products. The symptoms aren't quite as serious: nausea, elevated blood pressure, and tachycardia. At higher levels of nicotine exposure, there tends to be two phases of symptoms, with the first being slightly less severe than the second. At first, there's vomiting, cardiac dysrhythmia, and seizure. And later on, the symptoms take on hypotension, bradycardia, lethargy, and respiratory failure, which, of course, can be fatal. We know that nicotine can be fatal. Nicotine exposure can be fatal. There's been at least one documented death in upstate New York last year. A child who was about 1 year old ingested liquid nicotine and eventually died. We don't know exactly how much liquid nicotine or nicotine is fatal. The best estimates are somewhere between 0.8 and 13 milligrams per kilogram of body weight. I'll make that a little more concrete for you because I am not as familiar with the imperial system as I'm sure many of you, or the metric system as some of you are, I'm sure. So these are three random samples of nicotine that you can purchase on the internet, not scientifically selected, just by me for convenience. On the far left is a product that is unfortunately and ironically named Adam's Demise. It appears to be apple flavored. In the middle is a reference to everyone's favorite Michael Jordan Bugs Bunny comedy Space Jam. And on the right is a product that I'm sure is marketed to adults. It's Fruit Stripe gum flavored. The concentrations of nicotine increase as you go to the right, ranging from 6 to 25 milligrams per milliliter. You can find bottles of various sizes. 30 and 15 milliliters appear to be the most common. I should also say that this is the advertised level of nicotine, but because this is an unregulated market, what you see is not always what you get. And there have been studies that have found that the nicotine concentration varies widely from what is advertised. So if you take the estimates of what is a lethal dose of nicotine, and you take the middle, which is about 6 milligrams per kilogram of body weight, the average 20-month-old toddler weighs approximately 12 kilograms, which means it takes about 72 milligrams of nicotine for a fatal dose. Each of these bottles contains multiple fatal doses of nicotine. On the left, Adam's Demise requires about 12 milliliters or 2.5 teaspoons to be fatal. In the middle, Space Jam, only 4 milliliters or less than 1 teaspoon. And I should mention also, Space Jam at 18 milligrams per milliliter is sort of a medium level of nicotine. Most retailers on the internet advertise 15 to 20 milliliters per or milligrams per milliliter as medium, and concentrations do go up from there into the 20s and even into the low 30s of milligrams per milliliter. So while Fruit Stripe gum is a strong concentration, it's not the ceiling, and it requires only 2.8 milliliters, or about a half a teaspoon, which is a very, very small amount to be fatal to a toddler. Just to show you what else is out there, if you want to, you can purchase liquid nicotine concentrated to 100 milligrams per milliliter. It can be sold in 1 gallon jugs or smaller. You can get your hands on about a quarter liter at a time, which is not nearly as expensive as you would think. And once again, in an unregulated market, all you need is a credit card and an address to get your hands on this much poison. And obviously at these concentrations, it only takes a few drops to be fatal. And at this concentration, adults should be wary because mishandling of liquid nicotine can be bad as well. Nicotine is absorbed transdermally, so improper safety precautions could be bad as well. Obviously, this is marketed to vape shops that mix their own chemicals on site, but there are retailers that will sell it to you at this concentration, both in stores and on the internet. And apparently people buy it. So this concentration of nicotine is in households in this country. And if you really want to spend some money, you can buy this concentration in 55-gallon drums. And I'm not joking, all you need is a credit card. You can get it. So e-cigarettes are everywhere. Nicotine is toxic. So it comes as no surprise to anyone that poisoning is on the rise. I'm sure you've also seen this data from the American Association of Poison Control Centers. The reported exposures related to liquid nicotine in e-cigarettes is dramatically increasing. The numbers through 2015 are only current through September 30th, but we are absolutely on pace to meet the numbers of last year. So we have a public health problem that needs a public health solution. And when it comes to pediatric poisoning, far and away the best policy is to implement child-resistant packaging. So far, there have been at least 17 states that have taken steps to implement child-resistant packaging. The earliest laws in Minnesota, New York, and Vermont were implemented January 1st of this year, so they've been in place for almost 12 months. Some of these other states have passed policies that are not yet implemented, or they've passed policies that require health departments to do rulemaking that has not yet happened, but these are the states that have taken steps. Now we get to the legal mumbo-jumbo, which is why I'm up here. So when you're thinking about child-resistant packaging, there are a few policy considerations that a jurisdiction would need to think about. And the first question for any policy is, can you regulate? Can you do what you want it to do? And there are two parts to that question. First is, do you have the authority? And second is, are you preempted? And when it comes to authority, there's very little in the way of checks on state-level police power, which is why you've seen states take action. There's probably no restriction on state authority. But if you're at the local level, that will depend greatly on your state law and how your local level of government is organized. And that can be both the city and county level. Some cities and counties don't have the authority to regulate in this area, and some do. Now, even if you do have the authority, you also need to know whether or not you're preempted. Preemption occurs when a higher level of government prevents a lower level of government from taking a particular action. In this case, levels of government, I mean federal, state, and local. As to federal preemption, there is probably not federal preemption on child-resistant packaging, and that will probably remain the case until even after the FDA begins regulating e-cigarettes. I say probably because no one has challenged it, and sometimes rogue judges like to do things that you wouldn't think they would do. But the way the law is written, that's probably not the case. As to state-level preemption, if you're at a local level and thinking about child-resistant packaging, there are some states that have preempted this type of activity, so it depends on where you are. Now, after you know that you have the authority and you're not preempted and you want to take action, then you have to think about what exactly it is that you're going to regulate. In the e-cigarette market, there are sort of two types of products that you need to think about. They go by many different names, but I'll just, for our purposes, call them self-contained systems and open systems. The self-contained system, as I'm sure most of you are familiar, looks a lot like an ordinary combustible cigarette. In this example, the white part includes the battery and heating element, and the tan part that looks like a cigarette filter is the pre-filled liquid nicotine cartridge. On the varieties that are rechargeable, when the nicotine cartridge is expired, you simply throw it away and buy a new one, and the battery can be recharged. There are also disposable units where the entire unit is wasted after it's used. The open system also contains a heating element and a battery, but instead of having a pre-filled cartridge, contains a reservoir that is intended to be refilled by the user, and this is where you use all the liquid nicotine that I was showing you earlier. Some jurisdictions have exempted the so-called self-contained systems in their child-resistant packaging policies, some have not. So that's a question for a jurisdiction to grapple with as they're thinking about regulating. And the answer to that may depend on the legal infrastructure and the political climate. So you know that you can regulate, you know what you're going to regulate. The next question is, how do you regulate? And that means setting standards and then developing penalties and enforcement mechanisms. As to standards, states seem to be going in two directions for the most part. One is to establish or to reference the federal standards that are set by the Consumer Product Safety Commission. They're the federal agency that regulates child-resistant packaging of household products like bleach and other harsh chemicals. So the states that have referenced those standards have found that to be effective for the most part. The way that standard works, in case you're wondering and you really didn't have to take the time to dig into the regulations like I did, is that the Consumer Product Safety Commission gives an empty package to a group of 3.5 to 5-year-olds. They have 5 minutes to attempt to open the package. If they can't open the package, they're shown how to open the package and then given another 5 minutes. And if they still can't open the package, if 15% of less than 15% of the children who try can't open the package, then it goes on to the next phase, which is they make sure that adults can open the package. Right? Because anybody can make a package that's unopenable. So if the adults can't open it and the children, less than 15% of children can't, then you have a child-resistant package. And then sort of the other way to set the standard is simply to decide what type of packaging complies in your jurisdiction and then to mandate the use of that type of packaging. States seem to be sort of landing on the same type of packaging. And they're typically the sort of medicine bottles where you have to push down on the cap to turn in order to open them. That's what you're going to see for the most part in states that have policies. So then after you set the standard, you have to think about how you're going to enforce that law and what are the penalties. And this is another situation where states seem to go two ways. One is to simply fold this policy into existing licensing regulations for retailers. And that allows you to tap into the existing licensing scheme. So you already have things like retail inspections and penalties built right in. And the other nice thing about licensing is that the top penalty generally is the revocation of licensure, which is, you know, a good, tends to, the threat of that tends to make people comply. So the other way to do it is simply to have a standalone policy, but then you have to figure out what's going to happen with enforcement and penalties. And for the most part, it's still sort of going to look like going through licensure where you have retail inspections and then penalties for noncompliance. And the other thing to consider is the penalty has to be stiff enough to actually incentivize compliance. And unfortunately, there are a lot of jurisdictions that for various policies have not set penalties high enough. Okay, so that's child-resistant packaging, and that's obviously the best way to target poisoning. But I just wanted to highlight a couple of other policies that sort of indirectly get at the problem, and this is more for the benefit of those jurisdictions that can't actually implement child-resistant packaging. So in tobacco control, we sort of have the trifecta of policies that tend to curb use, youth access restrictions, smoke-free or aerosol-free air, and then taxation. So if your community doesn't have those three things in place, that is a really good place to start for anything, not just e-cigarettes, for other products as well. Those three policies tend to reduce consumption. If you're reducing consumption, fewer people are buying liquid nicotine, so a few fewer children will have access to liquid nicotine. As I said, it's an indirect way to approach the problem. The other one is, this one's probably a little bit more important, but prohibiting flavors. So if you have seen and smelled liquid nicotine, it does not smell like tobacco at all. It smells like candy. It smells very strongly of candy, and if you accidentally get it on your hands like I have, you smell like candy for like a day. So because the packaging is often bright and has pictures of fruit and dessert and things like that, and you have something that smells attractive, that is possible that that's, you know, attracting children to attempt to drink the liquid. So if you prohibit flavors and all you have out there is tobacco-flavored liquids, it's possible you're reducing the attraction of the product. And the other, excuse me, the other policy option to consider is the licensing and then restricting the licensing of retailers. So as I said, licensing is a powerful tool in tobacco control and is utilized all over the country. And once you have a good licensing law and you have robust enforcement, the next step you can take is to actually reduce the number of licenses that you allow. And you can do that simply by reducing the number, or you can target density. You can only have so many retailers within a certain number of square miles, or you can limit the location of retailers, and so, you know, buffer zones around schools and other youth-oriented facilities. So those are all good tobacco control policies generally, and they can sort of get indirectly at the problem of nicotine poisoning. So, once again, if you're working on tobacco control policy throughout the country, you have questions on child-resistant packaging or anything else, feel free to contact us. We work all around the country, and a lot of times people need legal help thinking through issues, so we are happy to help. And apparently I have a little bit of time for questions, if anyone has any.
4 minutes of questions.
There's a question. Oh, sure. I didn't do the testing. The Consumer Product Safety Commission, I wasn't able to find out how large their sample is, but the children are, it's a specific number of months, and it works out to being 3.5 to almost 5. I should also add about that, that standard is child-resistant, and sometimes people use the term child-proof. And if you have kids, you know nothing is child-proof, right? So, but as far as that standard goes, it's a pretty robust standard, and it tends to significantly reduce poisoning. Yes?
How do you call to poison centers for nicotine exposure compared to other products?
That's a good question. I've seen recently people have pointed out that there are significantly more calls for other sort of innocuous products and use that as an argument to not regulate. And the one thing to consider is that things like bleach and cosmetics and cleaners, detergents are in like every household in the country, right? So just by virtue of that, you're going to have more calls. Number of households that have liquid nicotine in them is significantly smaller. I've never seen anyone do like per capita, you know, but I suspect e-cigarettes are rising, if not eclipsing that. But in any case, just because the problem is smaller doesn't mean it's not a problem we shouldn't solve. But yeah, I don't know the exact numbers, but I know a lot of other products it's significantly higher. Just a question in the back?
Yeah, I'm wondering if there's an underlying factor for this one, some of the variations they also tested with the regulatory
That's a good question, and this would be pure speculation on my part because I don't know the exact answer. But you know, there are some states like New York had a death related to this, right? So they wanted a policy now. So whatever they could put together in their legislature and pass and get something on the books and implement it, that's what they were going to do. So you know, maybe they weren't calling up other states to find out what had happened. I know in Minnesota there was a lot of back and forth between both bodies of the legislature, and there was significant dialogue, and there was testimony from the vaping community and all sorts of stuff. And so they ended up referencing the federal standard. And I don't know if that was more acceptable to the people who were opposed, or I'm not entirely sure. But so the answer to your question is, I don't know, and there are a variety of reasons that might get to it.
Do these laws apply, or are they supposed to apply to internet sales in the states that have already?
That's a good question, and it probably gets more to enforcement than sales. So most of the laws will just talk about sale, and it would be sale within that jurisdiction. So theoretically, yes, they should apply to internet sales. But you know, there isn't any sort of unified federal regulation of internet sales at all. So whether or not the product that gets shipped has child-resistant packaging is a separate question, and whether or not the enforcement agency in that state can actually get at the packages that are coming in is another question. So theoretically, yes. In practice, you know, it's hard to tell.
Some states are passing laws that specifically mention internet sales. It's just not.
Right, yeah.
People hear that at the back? Some states are passing laws that deal with internet sales specifically.
Yeah, and not just specific to child-resistant packaging, too, but e-cigarette policy generally.
We'll hold the rest of the questions if you have more, and I think there are more till the end.